There's a section, page 184 to 190, which deals with a reference to the works of Haji Mirza Karim Khan. Someone has the sheets that give the other numbers here. British edition. You'll notice the footnote on page 184. Baha'u'llah doesn't refer to this gentleman by name. He says, for instance, a certain man reputed for his learning and attainments. Turns out that this is Haji Mirza Karim Khan, because we know he's the author of Theor Shadal Avam, that's mentioned on the next page. And also he figures in Baha'i history in different ways, most of them unpleasant. Haji Mirza Karim Khan was one of the self-proclaimed shaky leaders after Sayyid Kazim. That is, he didn't follow the Bab. He declared that he was the successor himself of Sayyid Kazim. He's the author of numerous works, including A Vicious Attack on the Babi Faith, written at the request of Nasiruddin Shah. If you'll look in God Passes By, page 91, you'll find a reference to that. There's also suspicion that he is the person referred to on page 248 of the Igon.
Could I interrupt you for a second? Because I don't know which page it is, and I don't have that. You know, somebody can tell me, maybe?
Does anyone have the British page on this?
What page?
It's 184, American.
118.
For those of you that are here now for the first time, we're working our way through, not reading everything, but we're talking about a lot of these points. And we're working our way through the Igon. We've been at it some time since end of May or something like that, I guess. You just jump ahead because we may not come back to this point later. We entreat the learned men of the Bayan not to follow in such ways, not to inflict at the time of the Mustaghas upon him who is the divine essence, the heavenly light, the absolute eternity, the beginning and the end of the manifestations of the invisible, that which hath been inflicted in this day. We beg them not to depend upon their intellect, their comprehension and learning, nor to contend with the revealer of celestial and infinite knowledge. And yet, notwithstanding all these admonitions, we perceive that a one-eyed man, who himself is the chief of the people, is arising with the utmost malevolence against us. We foresee that in every city, people will arise to suppress the blessed beauty, that the companions of that Lord of Being, and ultimate desire of all men, will flee from the face of the oppressor and seek refuge from him in the wilderness, whilst others will resign themselves and with absolute detachment will sacrifice their lives in his path. And then he refers to various figures here. We don't know who they are exactly. Again, he says, methinks we can discern one who is reputed for such devoutness and piety that men deem it an obligation to obey him, and to whose command they consider it necessary to submit, who will arise to assail the very root of the divine tree, and endeavor to the uttermost of his power to resist and oppose him. Now, my personal view on this is a reference to Yahya, because he was considered the figurehead of the Babis, and he was known to be so pious, and even if you see his photograph, he's looking very, very pious and humble in the photograph that they took of him too. The crook neck is a sign of humility. You know, you're in the presence of someone important and you crook your neck, it means that you're ready to have your neck cut off, I guess, to know quite what the implications of it are. But it's again an indication of humility, or feigned humility anyway. So be that as it may, this may be a reference. He was one-eyed. He was physically one-eyed, Haji Mirza Kairam Khan, as well as one-eyed in the sense of not being able to see straight, not being able to understand. Back to 184 again. If you want to identify knowledge as a light which God sheddeth into the heart of whomsoever he willeth, up above, this is a hadith of Muhammad. On the opposite page here, knowledge, down on 185, knowledge is all that is knowable and might empower all creation. This is the Imam Sadiq. Now, Baha'u'llah talks about having heard references to this man, and he's found some of his books, he perused them a couple times, and he says just from the title of the one book that he got, Guidance Unto the Ignorant, we perceive the odor of conceit and vainglory, inasmuch as the author hath imagined himself, he says here, a learned man, and regarded the rest of the people ignorant. His worth was in fact made known by the very title he had chosen for his book. He's saying that there are people who say they are knowledgeable and know and position themselves in authority amongst the people as being learned, and then inflict on the source of knowledge that which thou hast heard and witnessed. So he uses this man as an example. He refers in one of his books to the Miraj, which is the night journey of Muhammad through the seven heavens. He says, now this man lists 20 or more sciences which he considered essential for anybody to comprehend the Miraj. And among these sciences he specified the science of metaphysical abstractions, of alchemy and natural magic. Such vain and discarded learnings this man hath regarded as the prerequisites of the understanding of the sacred and abiding mysteries of divine knowledge. He paints this picture first of this man with all his book learning. And he quotes on page 187 with regard, how truly hath he said, quote, this is a quote from Rumi, all human attainment moveth upon a lame ass, whilst truth, riding upon the wind, darteth across space. Human learning is very heavy. Divine truth is another thing altogether, light itself. Then he says that by the righteousness of God, whoso desireth to fathom the mystery of this miraj, this night journey of Muhammad, and craveth a drop from this ocean, if the mirror of his heart be already obscured by the dust of these learnings, he must needs cleanse and purify it ere the light of this mystery can be reflected therein. He says, in this day they that are submerged beneath the ocean of ancient knowledge and dwell within the ark of divine wisdom, forbid the people such idle pursuits. Their shining breasts are, praise be to God, sanctified from every trace of such learning, and are exalted above such grievous veils. On page 189, he says, among the sciences which this pretender hath professed is that of alchemy. We cherish the hope that either a king or a man of preeminent power may call upon him to translate this science from the realm of fancy to the domain of fact, and from the plane of mere pretension to that of actual achievement. Now, alchemy is presumed to be the science whereby an elixir is made out of certain substances which elixir, if dropped in drops on another object, another metal, will change that metal instantly into the purest of gold. And in history, there's a long tradition of alchemists working on this and having secret formulas and trying to develop this. Now, Baha'u'llah is saying he should, if he thinks that this is one of the learnings that's necessary, he says, well, now, okay, produce the goods. Did you learn this? Are you, if you know this, then you say it's a prerequisite to understand the night journey, then can you show us some of the gold, so to speak? Can you prove it, literally? Then he adds this interesting passage. He says, would that this unlearned and humble servant himself, who never laid any pretension to such things, nor even regarded them as the criterion of true knowledge, might undertake the same task, that thereby the truth might be known and distinguished from falsehood. But of what avail all this generation could offer us were wounds from its darts, and the only cup it proffered to our lips was the cup of its venom. On our neck we still bear the scar of chains, and upon our body are imprinted the evidences of an unyielding cruelty. Baha'u'llah here condemns alchemy in its popularized form, but in a number of tablets on the subject, which he later undertook to reveal, he explains its inner meanings. Note his own reference here to such a possibility, that is, where he says that he might take it up himself. Page 189-190. He says, this humble servant might undertake the same task, that thereby truth might be known and distinguished from falsehood. And there are a number of these tablets already published in Persian, and others still to be published. In fact, one of the signs of the coming of age of the human race, as set forth by Baha'u'llah, is the discovery of the reality of alchemy, which will have a tremendous impact, I should think, not only on science, because of what it will imply in the realm of physics and chemistry and so on, but as you can imagine, on the world economy. If everybody can make gold, pure gold, it will change the value of such substance.
Sorry, when is the coming of age of man?
Coming of age of mankind is closely related to the establishment of the lesser peace. So the whole thing is...
So it might be worth it to go into that field and study that at this point.
Maybe you think you're the one who finds it out.
Maybe. It would be all right to read about it. One would not want to engage in it, as there are a number of tablets forbidding the Baha'is to engage in it. So I guess somebody else is really going to discover. I mean, there are strong admonitions for Abdul Baha to not engage in this at his time. Now, I don't know, the Guardian quoted those tablets too, but what it means for the Baha'is. But I think we'll find it'll be coming out in the world of science probably in some stage.
Sir?
One of
the Baha'is discovered the secret.
Under Baha'u'llah's, under the influence of Baha'u'llah and so on, I've heard it also said that Mirza Musa had discovered the secret, his brother, but that Baha'u'llah said it wasn't the time and to leave it, so he left. This is as far, but I've only heard it verbally. I haven't seen it written anywhere. But I've heard it from several sources. So Mirza Musa was very interested in this, was engaged in it for a time.
The conventional modern view of alchemy is just medieval quackery and thought through.
Yes.
So obviously, these writings and Baha'u'llah's inferences about it imply it's really it's much more involved than meets the eye.
Yes, they imply that it has a spiritual as well as a material meaning. The material meaning is really secondary to the spiritual meaning, because it describes processes which are parallel to spiritual processes that take place in the soul through suffering, through burning, through being brought to naught, through then coming to life, through finally being transformed, so that you have a gross, dense subject, material. so that the crude metal of human life may be transformed into the purest gold. He talks about this in the gleanings and in one of the prayers also. So it's the crude metal of human life is our own substance that becomes transmuted by the elixir of the Word of God. Acting on it changes its character completely, transforms it into something which it wasn't to begin with. And many of the alchemical writings seem to be revealing mysteries of that process rather than actually trying to represent the physical process. Although the physical seems to, in some cases, have reality too. But someone wrote and said, well, now we can already change things. You know, they've changed by pinging the balances or what you have in the atoms. They can change into gold, but it's such an expensive process. So they had mentioned this to the guardian. Again, this is a pilgrim note. But I think it's also confirmed in a letter. But, the guardian said that this was not what Baha'u'llah had in mind, the traditional methods. And it's not this modern system that he's talking about. The reality of alchemy as in old alchemy, the proving of the truth of it, of its possibility. That's a great mystery surrounds the substance that begins the process. That is that substance which you have to act on, which he refers to as the stone, which eventually gives out the elixir through various stages. The traditional teachings of alchemy are close to this, but there's so many different names used for each stage and for each substance, and it's cloaked in great mystery, not to be penetrated without the assistance of Baha'u'llah, I should imagine. But very interesting that all of this is recorded in tablets now, when it will be discovered in the future. That will be interesting for people to see. We still bear the scar of chains, he says. Baha'u'llah, as you know, was imprisoned in the Syed Chal of Tehran for 4 months. During this period, his neck was, quote, weighed down by a mighty chain. This is from God Passes By. And he received the intimation of his prophetic mission while freighted down with these heavy chains. And the scars from the galling weight of those chains remained with him the rest of his life. References, God Passes By, page 101. On page 191, there's a reference to this Samiri. The Samiri is a title of what the footnote says is a magician contemporary with Moses. But specifically, he's the magician or the sorcerer who tempted the Israelites to worship the golden calf when they were in exile and Moses was on the mountain. You can read about this in the Islamic version. The Samiri is not mentioned in the Bible, but he is mentioned in the Quran in the 20th surah, in verse 85. After this violation, he became an outcast wanderer, same figure. That would be the local version of a covenant breaker. I presume he was. I don't know if he must have been of the Jewish people if he was in exile with Moses.
As Quran, they said he was not Jewish because Moses brought that belief. He was a worshipper of statues. He was
idol worshipper.
Yeah, idol worshipper.
Whether he was of Jewish race or not, I mean, that's what I don't know. Certainly he wouldn't be truly Jewish in the sense of a follower of Moses. Good to check. Let me put a note down on that since this is being edited. Okay. Okay. Oh, my brother, this is the passage that leads into the section about the true seeker and his qualities. Would someone like to read that for us, 191 in the middle, that paragraph, like that in the following paragraph? We have some readers.
Oh, my brother, a divine mind only can deal with the gems of divine knowledge, and the fragrance of the mystic flower can be inhaled only in the ideal garden, and the lilies of ancient wisdom can blossom nowhere except in the city of the stainless heart. In a rich soil, its plants spring forth abundantly by permission of its Lord. And in that soil which is bad, they spring forth but scantily.
Now, what do you think Baha'u'llah is talking about here? What is he referring to? What do you understand by this paragraph? The more pure your heart is, the more you understand. Mm-hmm. Any other thoughts about it?
Maybe those who are searching for the one, the true one, they will only find it, or
mm-hmm.
they will only
require seeking.
Yes. Seekers, they will only get the right faith, right mind.
And any other thoughts?
Rich soil is also pendula. Rich soil is your abdomen, and the pendula is the pendula.
Rich soil, yes. The rich soil has been plowed and cultivated. Your gardener's here to help us out
tonight.
Yes? With the word mind capitalized here and flower and garden.
I understand somehow this, in my own words, that this for me means that one can only attain unto his true destiny if he attains to the presence of God.
Mm-hmm. He's telling the uncle of the Bab. He's been talking about this fellow with his vain and idle learning. He says the divine mind only can yield the gems of divine knowledge. In other words, only from a manifestation of God you're going to get gems of divine knowledge. And the fragrance of the mystic flower can be inhaled only in the ideal garden. In a sense, within the covenant, within the pale of recognition of the manifestation of God. And the lilies of ancient wisdom can blossom nowhere except in the city of a stainless heart. Now, he seems to change gears in the second part of the sentence. He doesn't capitalize things anymore. And he talks about these lilies of ancient wisdom. This is like the hyacinth of divine wisdom mentioned in the hidden words that can grow in a pure heart. And then he goes on and develops that. I don't know, so it would seem to have both these themes linked together. The turning and facing the manifestation of God and the requirement of purity and sanctity of heart to receive these riches, so to speak, to perceive these riches. Now, all of these things seem to be, these gifts of God seem to be latent in human reality, but they require a level of consciousness or perception oftentimes different from the one we have now, or sometimes we, in a condition of prayer, we become more receptive. We find ourselves thinking thoughts and meditating and finding meanings that we don't usually find when we look at the writings. Obviously, there are these different states, if you will, of the soul. And the words of God create in us this condition where we are able to reflect more of these divine truths shining on us from the Sun of Truth and capture them in the mirror of our consciousness and think about them and meditate on them, be inspired by them, be rejoiced by them. Inasmuch as it hath been clearly shown that only those who are initiated into the divine mysteries can comprehend the melodies uttered by the bird of heaven, it is therefore incumbent upon everyone to seek enlightenment from the illumined in heart and from the treasuries of divine mysteries regarding the intricacies of God's faith and the abstruse allusions in the utterances of the day springs of holiness. Thus will these mysteries be unraveled, not by the aid of acquired learning, but solely through the assistance of God in the outpourings of His grace. Ask ye therefore of them that have the custody of the scriptures, if ye know it not. This is a reference in the Quran. Now he comes to these prerequisites. Remember we were looking at the beginning here of the themes found in the Kitab-i-Iman as set forth in God Passes By on page 139. Shoghi Effendi says that Baha'u'llah enumerates the essential prerequisites for the attainment by every true seeker of the object of his quest in referring to this passage. And a few more related to it.
Excuse me, I didn't get the first number of that passage.
139. And he also describes in the subsequent passage that's connected with this, when he says, Baha'u'llah expatiates in glorious terms upon the glories and wonders of the City of God, renewed at fixed intervals by the dispensation of Providence, for the guidance, the benefit, and salvation of all mankind. And this section begins on page 196. We're coming up to it shortly. I think that of all the passages of the Iqan, perhaps this is the most celebrated one, the most that the Baha'is remember somehow, because it relates immediately to each of us. You think, well, I want to be a truth seeker. Now, what does he say you have to do in order to be a truth seeker? What are the requirements to seek the beloved, to seek the intended one? And if you want to take time to do this outside of class, you could actually list these, number them, and list these various prerequisites that he gives. There's a whole series of them. And think about, where do you stand? Where do I stand in relation to each one of these? Have I ever thought about it? Have I ever tried to do this? Do I think it's important? Have I noticed whether the other Baha'is think it's important? Does that matter? Does that affect what I do about it? Some of these are quite startling. Such as observe silence. I would finish the class, so we won't read that right away. All right. Would someone like to read that paragraph starting, but oh my brother, down to the end of the page there, and then we'll take a break and think about that a little bit.
But oh my brother,
When a true seeker determines to take the step of search in the path leading to the knowledge of the Ancient of Days, he must, before all else, cleanse and purify his heart, which is the seat of the revelation of the inner mysteries of God, from the obscuring dust of all acquired knowledge and the illusions of the embodiments of satanic fancy. He must purge his breast, which is the sanctuary of the abiding love of the Beloved, of every defilement, and sanctify his soul from all that pertaineth to water and clay, from all shadowy and ephemeral attachments. He must so cleanse his heart that no remnant of either love or hate may linger therein, lest that love blindly incline him to error, or that hate repel him away from the truth. Even as thou dost witness in this day how most of the people, because of such love and hate, are bereft of the immortal face, frustrated far from the embodiments of the divine mysteries, and shepherdless are roaming through the wilderness of oblivion and error.
Okay. See the first sentence from "But oh my brother," down to the embodiments of satanic fancy. What do you understand by this passage? When a true seeker determines to take the step of search in the path leading to the knowledge of the Ancient of Days. What's the Ancient of Days? God? The manifestation? Could be either one. Ancient of Days means the pre-existent of days. In other words, the pre-existent one. Ancient is always, is sometimes translated pre-existent and sometimes ancient. He who is eternal in character, not of time, before days or outside the succession of days. He must before all else cleanse and purify his heart, which is the seat of the revelation of the inner mysteries of God. What's we're talking about here? The human heart should be cleansed and purified, and he calls it the seat of the revelation of the inner mysteries of God. Now, I suppose this is a small r, and we should not understand by this the revelation in the sense of divine revelation, but a revealing, the appearance of, the reflection of, if you will, the light coming from the Ancient of Days, reveals itself in a clear and purified heart. Now notice that the organ of knowledge, of knowing, of perception, here is identified with the heart rather than with the brain. The head is the seat of the intellect, but the heart is the seat of intuitive knowledge. Now, he doesn't mean by that necessarily the physical organ of the heart, obviously, but the heart or essence, the soul, the essence of something, as distinct from the brain. This is important to think about. All of the Eastern religions teach this way. It's just in the West where we've decided that the whole of knowledge is up here in the head instead. And we've separated the two concepts. Because true knowledge also is related to feeling. It produces profound feelings. It's not just a mental exercise, so to speak. Now, what is this? He says that they should cleanse and purify the heart from the obscuring dust of all acquired knowledge and the illusions of the embodiments of satanic fancy. Yes. So I think that would be part of it. How do you get rid of it, though? If that's the only knowledge you have at the time you approach this, how are we going to know what's knowledge and what's acquired satanic fancy? Friends, I believe this is the most serious point that we ever reach. Is how to distinguish between truth and opinion, truth and whatever it is we've acquired from our families and our schooling and television and everything else. What is it that we have kind of, without even thinking about it, accepted as truth about life? even when we say Baha'u'llah is the messenger of God. What do we understand about the relationship that the human soul should have with the messenger of God? What do we understand about what society's relationship should be with the messenger of God, when the example all around us is of something entirely opposite to that, quite different? We have no precedent. We are understanding from each other some of this, of how it is to be a Baha'i. We see it, we feel it from each other. But it's still early. Yes. Yes, essential, really. Now Baha'u'llah says this, talks about prayer and fasting as the sun and moon of revelation, you know? Fasting and prayer. Fasting and obligatory prayer, actually, specifically. And there are passages from Abdu'l Baha'i. It says this, everything will come from these. These two alone, if you're faithful, use them faithfully, they will lead to a changing of soul. So all the instruments are placed in our hands, really, for gradually coming to grips with these veils of idle fancy. You see this in the prayers all the time. Idle fancies, vain imaginings. These are reflections that we get from each other and from books and from school and from popular ideas and from newspapers and from everything else around us. What people take to be. Well, that's the way it is. That's fact. That's reality. That's very hard for us to kind of step back from who we are and the time we are to see how foolish some of this is. And also how obscuring it is, how darkening it is to our souls. Each of us have the various subcultures too. I mean, look away, particular youth are always in rebellion, so to speak, against the established society. But at the same time, they've taken on a certain way of looking at the world, which is also a prejudiced way of viewing, you know. And then they're afraid to kind of depart from that, because then the other youth, you won't be popular if you don't do what everybody else, if you don't think or rebel in the same way that everybody else rebels. All of these are chains and bonds holding us. How can we free ourselves from them? I think this is very important. Prayer is one of the keys. Even if we go home tonight and we say, I wonder how much I'm missing of all of this. I just ask Baha'u'llah, help me to understand what is the next step that I should take to draw closer to you, to achieve fuller understanding, to begin to strip away some of these veils, to begin to fulfill the purpose that you said I've been created for, to know thee and to worship thee. He must purge his breast. Purge is a strong word. Got to get a big, powerful hose in there and spray it all out. Remove the muck. Which is the sanctuary of the abiding love of the Beloved, of every defilement. And sanctify his soul from all that pertaineth to water and clay, from all shadowy and ephemeral attachments. Let's just think about that a little bit. He must so cleanse his heart that no remnant of either love or hate may linger therein. What does he mean by this? Thought love was a good thing. Now he's saying here, doesn't want it to be there. What kind of love is he talking about then?
Love for the things of this world.
Love for the things of this world.
The pleasures.
The pleasures of this world.
And also relationships, human relationships.
Human relationships. Love for other human beings. If that's the kind of a love that holds you back in relation to God, in your love to God, if you use that as a replacement, as a substitute love, that satisfy yourself with that.
The image is a certain degree, certain height that is keeps you back from God.
Excessive attachments to things or to each other or to whatever, to ambition, even sometimes it's an ambition we've set ourselves a goal and we're moving towards that goal. It doesn't happen to be the goal Baha'u'llah wants for us, but we are going to get that goal. We are going to be a millionaire. I mean, that's a simple version of it, but lots of people have set themselves a goal like that. I'm going to be famous. Famous for what? What good will it be? What use will it be? How dangerous will it be for your soul? I'm going to be rich. With fire we test the gold, and with gold we test our servants, he says. You want it, and I want you not to have it. That's what the hidden words tell us. You want to be rich? I don't want you to be rich. Then he says, happiness is being content with what I have ordained for you, whatever it is. Whatever the circumstances of our lives. You know?
How do you distinguish what is ordained? Because sometimes you think, okay, you are told that you have to strive for things that you have, but then when it doesn't happen, you have to be content. At what point do you know to let go?
At what point do we know it's God's will that something is not meant to be? I remember hearing a pilgrim talk about this. Shoghi Effendi was saying somebody had said that they wanted to, I don't know, buy some property or something for the faith. And then they said, but it wasn't the will of God. And Shoghi Effendi said, the will of God is like this. You see what you want, you come to the door, and you knock. If it doesn't open, you pound. If it still doesn't open, you push it with your hand. If it still doesn't open, you throw the whole weight of your body against it, over and over. And if it still doesn't open, then maybe it's the will of God. Don't give up too soon, too easily, on what you think you're supposed to be doing. Now, especially if it's a goal of a property for the faith, that works. If you happen to have the wrong goal altogether, the door may open and you'll find yourself falling through space or something undesirable.
What's meant by ephemeral?
Ephemeral. Ephemeral. What is all shadowy and ephemeral attachments? Passing. Ephemera? Do you have it in French? Ephemera? It's a well-known Spanish word, too. I don't know. There must be something equivalent to that. Anyone else know French that knows what this means? No. Ephemera, it's Latin. It should be... You should be able to find ephemera, I think. It's based on a Latin root. Something very... not solid, you know. Passing would be a passing attachments, shadowy, improper, passing attachments. Yes.
Question about being content. You said we should be content with what God has ordained for us, but also it says that we should never be content with ourselves. So are those two different?
That's right. We should not be content with our discontent at not accepting the will of God. That's one way of looking at it. Did you follow that? The double negatives there. All right. One of the things is we're always rebelling and restless because I don't want to be doing this, or what am I doing this for? Or why am I here? Instead of seeing how we can infuse into whatever it is we're doing the right qualities, you know. It's this way of looking at life, instead of always living tomorrow or yesterday, just using the time we are now to try to be expressive of divine qualities and try to draw close to God now, not tomorrow morning or this weekend, I hope, or something like that, you know. Okay, he must so cleanse his heart that no remnant of either love or hate may linger therein, lest that love blindly incline him to error or that hate repel him away from the truth. Well, this some of the Baha'is get confused by these passages. They say, wow, goodness, I thought we were supposed to love all mankind. We're supposed to love our wives and we're supposed to husbands or whatever. Wife. That's the what we. In Unfolding Destiny, page 457 to 58, written on his behalf, he says, "We must never take one sentence in the teachings and isolate it from the rest. It does not mean we must not love, but we must reach a spiritual plane where God comes first, and great human passions are unable to turn us away from Him. All the time we see people who, either through the force of hate or the passionate attachment they have to another person, sacrifice or bar themselves from the path of God. We must love God, and in this state a general love for all men becomes possible. We cannot love each other, we cannot love each human being for himself, but our feeling towards humanity should be motivated by our love for the Father who created all men." This is a beautiful quotation. So copy it off in your prayer book or something, because it's the secret to all of this. The right relationship with everybody else proceeds from the love of God. If you have the love of God, then you are permitted great love of others, because it's the outcome of the flow of the love of God through you. And the most attractive people you see in the world are these people that they love God so much that all of that spills onto you, and you feel so good when you're around them, because you feel like their love is reaching you as well, and somehow it affirms the truth of God and the truth of the love of God. I remember how impressed I was with some of the hands of the cause that were traveling, especially when they were talking to groups of Baha'is, because they would just get transformed, you know. You would see that, and you'd feel like you could see another condition of the human soul that you couldn't find otherwise, so to speak. Well, this is enough. This subject, you know, you can discuss it forever and ever, each sentence practically. If you take this and you run a parallel between these passages and the Valley of Search, you'll find all kinds of connections. If you read the hidden words in relation to these, you'll find other cross-references. And you can juxtapose, you can place these quotations in relation to each other, and their meanings will unfold before you. This is an important way of studying, is to think, where have I seen something like that before? Let me find it here in a letter of the Guardian. Let me look in the Seven Valleys at the beginning in the valley of search, he says clearly, it is incumbent on these servants that they cleanse the heart, which is the wellspring of divine treasures. So it's revelation of divine mysteries, wellspring of divine treasures, same thing. From every marking, and that they turn away from imitation, which is following the traces, the footsteps of their forefathers, the ways that people saw things before them, so to speak. And shut the door of friendliness and enmity upon all the people of the earth. This is the same thing of friendliness and enmity, love and hate, mentioned here. Okay, someone read from "That seeker must at all times" to the end of that paragraph. Okay, stop there, please. So we have trust in God, renouncing the peoples of the earth, detachment, cleaving under the Lord of Lords, never exalting ourselves, washing away the tablet of every trace of pride and vainglory, clinging under patience and resignation, observing silence and refraining from idle talk. We'd take a test, you know. 24 hours. See if we can give up idle talk. Observe ourselves, what we say to people, and ask ourselves, is this idle talk? Will this lead to any benefit for these people? Is it any benefit to me, what I'm saying to them? Why am I chattering away? Why am I talking? What am I saying? Am I being friendly? Do I want attention? Do I want to impress upon these people what I know? Lots of questions you can ask yourself in your dealings with other people. It's tough going. You don't want to do it more than 24 hours. It's depressing. The other thing is try then the next 24 hours shutting up and not saying those things. Well, people decide you're sick or you're not feeling well or something's the matter with you. You have to be kind and friendly. But all the little things you're going to tell about what happened to your kitchen and the thing that happened here and what happened there and I spilled something and I did this and the things we tell each other that really just eat up our time. But to counterbalance that, you have to show a lot of love and kindness to people. Then, if you're not thinking about those things and saying those things, then what are you doing, you know? And you start filling up that time with something else. May Maxwell was talking to me in her talks, in her teachings. She's the mother of Bri Akano. She's a great Baha'i teacher, one of the mother teachers, you could say, of the faith. And she said that she had learned from the master that you should always have the greatest name on the altar of your heart. That is that if you listen closely, if you stop and be quiet, you'll find the soul is repeating Allahu Abha. It's feeding itself. When it doesn't have something else to do, it returns to the greatest name. It tries to center its thoughts. it tries to feel the sunlight of God shining on it, because it's shining all the time. Idle talk and vain pursuits are like clouds that shroud the sun from shining on the soul. All you do is refrain from them, the clouds disappear. Sunlight starts shining. Big challenge. Infinite stages and degrees in the process. Well worth beginning. If you've begun and if you're working, you know how worthwhile that is. Now, Arada Bhatt says about us that often, how often it is that a soul will make efforts and then suddenly we'll go back to the beginning again. Start all over again. It's a strange human characteristic we have. We get started all right and we think this is great and why are we really getting a lot out of this? And I have to read the text every day. Why don't I read more? Gosh, I was happy praying. Why don't... Then we stop again. When we take it up again, we say, gosh, this is great. Why didn't I do this? Back to the start again.
There's a posterity in meaning where you said that the conversation carried on by us should to influence the justice beneath our feet, that would be thrilled.
Uh-huh. So listen to yourself for 24 hours. We listen to ourselves. I have to listen too. And see what it is we're saying. Is it something that would thrill the dust under our feet, or would it all cover its head in shame and say, my God, the people that live on top of me.
Sometimes I wonder about the dust on the floor and the dining room and the seat. When you hear it all the nonsense
about. You see that carpet, is it cringing because of the conversations held in the lunchroom? Who knows? So we can examine ourselves and the carpet at the same time. Now, while you're busy examining yourself, try not to listen to the other people's conversation, because then you'll get really serious, you know, feeling very good about, I'm not doing it, I'm just listening to it, or I'm not doing it, but listen how badly that one is carrying on. So first he tells us to shut up, really, in a nice way. Then he says, and don't backbite. Maybe because it comes so easy after you take the first steps of shutting up, then you see how bad everybody is. You think to yourself. In a letter from Shoghi Effendi, he says that he talks about the dark forces of life, which are these forces of selfishness and passion and prejudice. He says that they can come into the soul. And one of the ways that we let them into the soul, he says, is when we think or feel negatively about other people or about our fellow believers, he happens to say in that instance. Think or feel negatively. Now, most of us reserve the right to think and feel negatively about each other. We know it's not proper to say to somebody else, so-and-so is really out of line and is driving me crazy. So don't say that. We just think it to myself, this guy's driving me crazy. Wish this guy would drop dead, you know, some polite little phrase we have in our mind. If he keeps on like this, I'm going to poke him in the nose. Now, all of that seems to be improper from what we can tell here, and certainly just fills us with all kinds of negative feelings and negative qualities. How can we remove these things? First of all, we have to recognize that we're imperfect. Second, we have to have compassion and realize that that's the nature of human beings. Imperfection. Basic human condition. Everybody's imperfect. Why should we be so startled? Why should we be upset when we see imperfections in other human souls? Are they saying they're perfect? And then we get so busy shaking our finger at others, you know, why aren't they good Baha'is, you know? We don't see ourselves standing there shaking our finger. And God standing behind us looking at us, poor things. You don't know what they're doing. So he says, you know, center your energies on taking care of your own shortcomings. You don't know what the gifts are God has given you. Maybe he's giving you many more gifts than the other souls around you. and you say, well, I'm a little better than the rest of these anyway. But God has made you much better. He's given you much more. And He's going to judge you harshly if you don't develop those qualities and gifts that you have, that nobody else has. That's all we can do, is try to improve ourselves in relation to what He's given us. It doesn't matter what the others are doing. And if the quality of all the Baha'is seems to us so low that we say to ourselves, how can the faith ever progress? We should think, God, let me change into that one soul that can change a nation. He says, one soul can transform a whole country. One soul can take on a quality of faith and belief that will impact and startle and arrest other souls, cause them to be dumbfounded by witnessing this, if we could attain it. We'll work on that for a while. Well, sure, but that's an expression then, not of backbiting, but of
concern.
You have to find a way to do it, of course. I'm sure you know ways to do it, but we all do. But
would you say you know someone's stepping out of line, and you and another Baha'i are talking about it out of concern in the first step to trying to help them? Is that still considered backbiting, or is that?
You have to ask yourself, you know. It's very hard from outside to judge. You have to be careful that if we want to be loving, we really want to help so and so. But as Baha'is, we find ways to talk about them in this concerned manner, you know? So we talk to each other about, we really have to help Sammy. You know, poor fellow. He doesn't know any better. Such a simple soul. And you see, and you know, we have to be patient with him. We have to find a way to get him to be different than he is. You know? He says he doesn't want to go to movies. Let's find a way to get him to the movies. We say all kinds of things. Adavas says, even speaking well of people sometimes is backbiting. You hear people saying that. So-and-so. No, the so-and-so, they say, you know, Elaine, she's such a sweet soul. My goodness, is she sweet. You're saying, such a stupid, innocent person I never saw in my life, you know. But you're saying it in sweet words. You're saying something kind, but you're meaning something else. And sometimes we don't do very much of it, just a little of it. We don't even caught out at it. We don't even want to know we're doing it ourselves, you know. We don't want to catch ourselves doing it. So we're just on the edge a little bit. But if it's all right, you can say it genuinely. But check yourself. Be sure that it's genuine, you know. And then maybe what does it evoke in the other person? The other person says, yeah, she's a sweet person. Real unenthusiastic. You know what they really think, you know, but they're saying, well, yeah. Yes, they're nice. I like that. Nice person. Not anything to impress anybody, but nice.
You also said, Mr. Dunbar, that, I don't know if you were saying this half sarcastically or just to make a point, but you said that you were talking about each individual should concentrate on their own self. And also you said that each person is endowed with so many more gifts than the other person. And should we really be thinking that way? Like, I have more gifts than the person next to me?
No, I mean it in the sense of that we may be endowed with more gifts, since the question of gifts is a mystery. You know? It's you remember this story about, as an example, that we have two souls here. One been given capacity by God to count to 100, and one has been given capacity to count to 20. And this fellow over here is now counting to 19. And this fellow who can count to 100 is counting to 25. And he's looking down at the fellow who counts to 19. And he's saying, poor soul, you know, I'm better than he is. And God is looking down and says, the guy who can count to 20 is counting to 19. He's really high up in the scale of achievement. And this fellow who could count to 100 is only counting to 25. And he's priding himself on it. We can't tell how God is judging us. He doesn't judge us by how we're doing in relation to others. He judges us by how we're doing in relation to the gifts He's given us. So the only comparison you can make with yourself to see if you're doing all right is Abdu'l-Bahá. That keeps you humble, obviously. And that's going to fix your condition of are you self-satisfied with your progress or not. Not by looking at those people around us, our fellow believers. No? Not by looking at the house members. Not by looking at anybody. Only looking at the Master. Then we understand.
I want to ask the question of what we need is so because still it's not yet me. What we, because if we are just, maybe you said we have to talk of somebody, is somebody learning from what you say, and maybe we really like it, and we really have to, like, to be really boring to those people who are listening to us, because really focusing yourself on, I don't know, and we also have to be loving and kind and, you know.
Yes. Yes, I think it's a balance. It's a question of moderation. Do we take up our time and other people's time with a lot of idle chatter? When we say light jokes and things, and we're meant to cheer each other up, and because there is the requirement of courtesy and sociability and being sociable and inquiring about other people's feelings and what's happening with them and so on. It's just to not be immoderate in it, I think, is basically the thing. Then also, we're talking here about a true seeker who's trying to find God, trying to find the manifestation of God even, because we don't know whether in this case, you know, he's saying the prerequisite. If you want to find truth, look in this way. Then he comes to recognize the true manifestation of God. Now, in a sense, we've recognized, but there are then these degrees of recognition of the brightness of his light, of the presence of the Beloved in our souls, you know, of God within man or reflected in man, as he says is his true state or condition. And so there's obviously many degrees in this. As we attain to that, then speaking has a different effect, because everything that we say has the effect of love, has the effect of being prompted by divine qualities, by spiritual qualities. Of course, that's the hard stage to reach. But at the beginning he says you should observe patience, resignation, observe silence, and refrain from idle talk. Again, as I say, I just try it as an experiment to observe in a 24-hour period or in a couple of days, what do I do with my time? What are my conversations? What do they consist of? Is there a way that I could raise the tone of them somehow? Could I be positive rather than negative? Am I snippy? Am I always critical of the weather or of the heat or of something, anything, just to be negative, 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 you know? Or am I looking for positive things? It's like the Master says, you know, looking for the good qualities, even though there's bad ones all around, focusing on something. Finding a good quality in someone and praising them for it. Think of the effect that it has on us when someone praises something about us, says something nice about us, anything. And how the practice of love requires that, in a sense, that if we do that with each other, all of us will be energized, you know, we'll be filled with more vitality, more hope. We can draw a lot on each other if we practice more and more of these things. And of course a lot of that is going on amongst us right now already. As Baha'is who have arisen to give their energies selflessly at the World Center, you've already taken major steps, major spiritual steps just to come here, to be here. Now you have these advantages of being in the shower of tests, because the World Center is a source of great tests. Why? Because Baha'u'llah is making the bounties commensurate with the character of your service. And in order for you to receive those bounties, you have to be tested. And as we're tested, then we become more receptive to what's really here. Do we have any idea where we are in the proximity of these shrines? We're sitting here in a class in the shadow of the shrine of the Bab, you know, right here. That shrine's influence reaches around the whole world. What must it be with 50 meters away or something? Please.
On the subject of test, how can you tell I think I might have asked you this question already. I still have a problem recognizing text, because something may happen to you in your life that they just go by you. You know, I don't recognize it as text. Sometimes I say I'm not being tested. I mean, how do you know you're being tested?
Abdu'l-Bahá once said that tests are like rocks in a river. Some people trip over every rock and fall in the water, and some walk over the top of them. Now, some of the tests that you get, you may find are just a means for crossing the river. No problem. Other times we have tests that we slip and half drown before we realize what we did wrong, or we soon get the idea that all is not well. But there is a section in the prayer book for those that want more tests, if you both ways. Yes. If you're gonna say the one, you better say the other. I suggest using them in tandem. No, it maybe means that you're in conformity with the will of God. I mean, because it's getting out of conformity with the will of God that brings tests, really, in a sense. But there's also favors that God sends us. He sends us tests because He knows what will most awaken us and free us from our attachments and things like that. You know, He knows exactly where the vital point is, where the Achilles' heel is. He sends us those tests. Now, if you don't receive any tests, well, maybe God is very pleased with you. This is true.
Well, maybe you're not identifying the ones that you have.
Well, it's all right. Then that's okay, because tests do become blessings. I mean, the tests that used to bother us, now you see, after you look back on them, you say, how could I have ever been so disturbed about those things? You know, so petty, so silly. They weren't important.
Other pastors in the writings would say the tests are the lot of the chosen ones of God and His favorite souls. So maybe if you're not being tested, He doesn't like you that much. And if you are being tested, maybe He likes you more than the average.
Did you all hear that? That's a good problem. Sammy, speak to me. What's happened here? I was at the Egon class on Sunday. I'm sorry. Not talking to anybody anymore. Oh, you'll all know, but the others won't know what's happened to you in case you quiet down now. I don't know, really. How can you answer that? It's a hard question to answer. I don't think you can require people to respond in certain ways, you know, even if you'd like them to. And the point is that we shouldn't make our behavior dependent on good response from the other people, you know. Abdu'l-Bahá says the love that we express should be like the light of the sun. It shines, its quality is to shine. It shines on everybody. Doesn't say, oh, I shine a lot on you, but I don't shine on you, and I shine a lot on you, but I don't shine so much on you, and this kind of thing. It doesn't do that. It just shines. And he says it shines equally on the home of the rich and the poor, of the saint and the sinner. It shines. It doesn't discriminate. Now, if it meets a pure heart and that light reflects back at it and it brings it satisfaction, it's pleased. But it doesn't stop its shining if it isn't reciprocated.
So,
good method to observe silence and see if it is reflected, that friendship is reflected, then it's fine. If not, it's shining.
Should still keep shining, yeah.
And not to talk, not to tell them, who's coming, I wanted you to do this.
I don't know. Yes, I suppose they would. Really. It's hard to give a formula answer for that, you know, because each situation would be different with it, with everybody that we know. The father says, "I never expected this of you, son," and the son says, "Dad, why do you always act a certain way?" Oh goodness. Well, most of you are too young for that yet. I mean, you know about your dad, but you don't know about your son yet. So next week we'll take this up some more. He should be content with little. Brings us over to page 194, bottom
193, 194.
We need someone to open the hall next week and